This podcast is sponsored by Lucy Pet and Equus Grooming Products. All right, welcome to another episode of Doc Halligan Unleashed with Joey Villani. And I have a, a flash from the past. I absolutely adore, miss him because I just loved working with him. It is Officer Cesar Perea. Did I say your name right?
Yeah, actually it's Captain Cesar Perea.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's Captain. Fine.
Wow, okay.
Well, I just want to let you know, she talked you up big. It was when she said, Cesar's going to come on the show. Cesar was going to, I haven't seen her that excited. So I don't know what you guys did together, but, you know.
No pressure,
very excited.
Right?
Yeah. No, I worked at the SPCLA for, 15 years. Worked with a lot of officers and captains, and Cesar was by far the best captain, the best to put in a case together, the nicest guy, love his girlfriend. And we actually put some people in jail that were hurting animals.
Absolutely.
My
favorite pastime.
Cesar, tell us a little bit about being a captain. What was the training that you had to go through? And how long have you been doing this?
Well, I've been in law enforcement my entire adult life. I mean, I started with the San Diego Sheriff's Department when I was 20 years old. Went to a police academy to go to the Sheriff's Department. And then a few years into that, I went to the San Diego Police Department as a patrol officer, went to the academy again, and worked for the San Diego Police Department for a little over 8 years as a patrol officer, and worked a lot of specialized units. I was very fortunate to work a lot of different types of investigations. I've also worked for the San Diego Humane Society as an investigations lieutenant. And for almost the last decade, I've been here in LA with the SPCA LA as a captain of investigations. The training for a humane officer is a little bit different as a police officer, and that it's more specific as to the type of investigations that we get involved with. So it's all animal related. In the regular police department, you don't get very much animal or animal type of investigations. So when I became a humane officer, you just get saturated with everything having to do with animals, investigating animal cruelty, et cetera. I mean, investigations are all the same, no matter what you're working on. I mean, it's detective work. It's going out and pounding the pavement and finding the bad guy. But with animal crimes, it's a little bit different. There's a lot of nuances. And that's where your specialty would come in, because animal cruelty investigations are very unique, and that the veterinarian plays an enormous role in proving a case.
Right. The veterinarian is really the only witness that can go on and actually talk about what kind of cruelty is going on because of our training, correct?
Yeah, and the statute specifically requires you to prove some levels of suffering. So you basically, the veterinarian has to come in and describe the level of suffering, neglect, et cetera, that an animal may have experienced. So the veterinarian becomes the voice that describes the pain and suffering that an animal may be experiencing.
At what point does it become serious enough where you get involved? And, you know, I mean, the reason why I say that is in pet grooming, we see cases of abuse, some minor, some a little bit more serious. Mm-hmm. At what point is it that someone like you would get dispatched?
Well, we're a very unique organization in that we go out on everything. We'll go out on a dog that's been tethered too long, all the way up to serious felony crimes. So from our standpoint, from our department, we go out on everything. We have gone out on groomer type calls where people leave on dryers too long, animals get burned. They're a little too heavy-handed trying to control a dog that's not cooperating. So we have gone out on groomer type calls. So if we get a complaint that an animal's in need, no matter what level of neglect or suffering is experiencing, we'll go out on it. We'll respond. Whether we prosecute or educate, that's where we kind of draw a line and specifically decide, okay, this person doesn't really understand, you know, that that choking out this dog to try to get it to groom it is not appropriate, that there's other more positive methods of trying to get a dog to do what you want the dog to do versus someone who is being intentionally cruel, trying to control a dog or being neglectful to the level that rises to a crime.
I guess what I was more or less talking is we see a lot of what, and it's hard to say if, you know, where you draw the line, where it's abuse. I'm going to give you an example. Uh-huh. We had a woman that had 6 poodles. She brought them to us. The dogs always came in horrific condition, but you could tell they were fed. You could tell they were happy. The one dog must have had an erection for a month. And we had a hospital that was next to us. And mm-hmm. I brought it to the vet, and that vet said, I wouldn't even know what to do. He says, this wow. has to be removed. When we brought it to their attention, they didn't care. Yeah. They did not care at all. It was kind of blown off. And here in New Jersey, we found it very difficult for someone to be able to follow up to see, you know, what the well-being of this pet was. And we didn't mm-hmm. have many options. We actually got a hold of the right people after doing a lot of research, and they checked up on the dog. They actually took the dogs away from the family because wow. when they went there, I guess the situation was a lot more severe. Mm-hmm. So it's great to hear that, you know, in California you have something like this, because 7 miles out of Manhattan in New Jersey, we don't have that those resources, mm-hmm. unfortunately. And, you know, coming from a pet groomer, because I see 20, 30 dogs a day, you would think, you know, we see different levels. And when you see a certain level, you know, this is probably a little bit more serious. Who can we reach out to? And yeah. we didn't have that.
Yeah, most agencies, police departments, municipalities, or even county unincorporated areas, they do have animal control agencies. Unfortunately, sometimes that's a job that the cities don't give too much priority to. So investigative wise, you don't always have someone that's highly skilled that can come in and do a complex cruelty investigation. But that example, you gave a really good example, because that's a situation where maybe the owner didn't know that this was causing some type of harm or wasn't aware of it. So that's where we step in and go, okay, I'm making you aware that this is, you know, medically is happening to your animal. And then I can mandate medical care. So I can step in and go, okay, I want a certain level of care. And we explain it to the owner and explain to them why the animal needs this level of care. And then if they refuse to do it, then they start stepping into the criminal part of failing to provide veterinary care. But that's where I think my department is very skilled in coming in and educating people first and saying, okay, you know, it's part of our mission statement. It's come in and educate people and say, hey, you need to do this. And some people go, oh my God, I had no idea. And they fix it. They either provide vet care, they do what they can and acknowledge it because they care for the animals. And like you said, the person just doesn't care. I'm not going to do anything about it. And then you get to the point where we're seizing all your animals and prosecuting you for not providing proper care.
And I know when I have testified in court, intent, like what you're talking about, that's really mm-hmm. what differentiates whether they get prosecuted. If you can prove there was intent to intentionally harm the animal versus someone just being ignorant.
Exactly. Well, I guess in your case, Doc, you're the mouthpiece for the animal, because, you know, I guess in some cases you're the only one that could speak because they can't. Mm-hmm. And you can prove things that, you know, that most people cannot.
Yes. And as veterinarians, we do not get any training on animal cruelty at all. I was very nervous the first time I had to go in a courtroom Madeline Bernstein, who's the president of the SPCA-LA, kind of sat me down and, you know, said, you need to do da, 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 da. And I was like, okay. So I go in, I'm in my lab coat lined up with everybody, and the judge is having everybody state your name. Madeline shares this story when she goes, and I said, Karen Halligan. And he goes, did you or did you not go to vet school? And I said, I did, Your Honor. He goes, well, then isn't your name Dr. Karen Halligan? So I said, yes. And so the reason I say that is it's just a game. It's like, right, Caesar? I mean, it's all about perception. And, you know, I didn't know that I should say doctor because I didn't want to offend everybody that I was better than them and I'm in the coat,
in a sense you are, because you considered an expert witness, because you went to vet school, because you specialize
in
you know, whatever your discipline is, it makes you an expert and the court will recognize you as that. And you carry a lot more weight with a jury, because anytime we're putting a case together, we're doing an investigation. And as you know, the entire time you're working a case, you're presenting it, you're working on it to present it to a jury, because that's who you have to convince, not your boss, your supervisor, or whoever. It's a jury that has to agree with what you did and the evidence that you're now finding in this investigation. So when you come in and say, you know, I'm Dr. Karen Halligan, and you get sworn in as an expert, the jury gives you a little more weight on what you have to say versus someone who's just a witness, or, you know, they randomly saw something that occurred. Your expertise is very important and does carry a lot of weight. So in a sense, when you say, you know, people look at you and you don't want them to think that you're better than they are. Mm-hmm. Well, in a courtroom, you essentially are, in the sense that you're a much more valuable, a valuable witness when you're testifying.
And we lost the very first case I ever, you know, it was a rabbit case, where a substitute teacher came in. Teacher was sick that day, and they said they were teaching special ed kids. They had a rabbit in a bag in the cupboard that they left over the weekend. Mm-hmm. So they took this rabbit out, and that's, you know, they basically suffocated it. That's what the teacher had said. How do you want to kill this rabbit that we're going to dissect? And they just decided they'll put it in a bag and suffocate it. So the SPCA got involved, because that's animal cruelty. So I was up there, I testified, and we were doing great. And then they had to, there was one juror that was biased, so they had to do it again. And the second time we went, I guess this teacher who's from Belize, they couldn't prove maliciousness, because in his country, that's an okay way to kill a rabbit, is to suffocate it, put it in a bag, and leave it for the weekend. And they won that, and we lost that case.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It goes back to what you said about intent. I mean, if this person truly thought that that was a humane way of euthanasia, you know, in his heart, this is what he thought was doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to convict him would be challenging, and it's probably in the best interest of the courts to dismiss the case in something like that. I mean, if that's truly what his mindset was going into his actions. And I specifically remember the case that we worked on, which is one of your last cases that you worked when you were with us, was the guard dog case. And that was, in my opinion, that's one of the biggest cases that I've worked on probably in my career. I mean, at least the top 10, and that the outcome was very satisfying to see that he was prosecuted. So basically what it was a guy that was running a guard dog business that would provide these large breed guard dogs to construction sites, malls, you know, anywhere. You probably used to see it a lot more 25, 30 years ago, before video surveillance was you know, the technology was what it is today. So people used to use guard dogs to protect their businesses. So this guy had at one time very lucrative business, but as it started to go away, you know, his customer base started to go away. He started getting a little more desperate and was cutting corners. Long story short, we got a complaint that a dog had a prolapse at his facility. We went on the property and we found three dogs that were deceased. Wow. And the dogs were dead in three separate truck compartments. He used to drive retired animal control trucks. So we found these three dead dogs and we ended up impounding these dogs from the location. And we took them. I still remember that night. I mean, it was really hot. It was in June or July. It was really, really hot. We pulled those bodies out and I called Doc and I go, Doc, you need to hang back. I'm bringing you these three bodies and I want to do a preliminary necropsy exam. And I rushed down there. We got into the exam room and Doc started doing these exams of these dogs. And a lot of what Doc was speculating on, we ended up proving later scientifically with the necropsies, et cetera. But that case went on. It was a 2-week trial at Compton Court. And I still remember I was very confident that we were going to get convictions, felony cruelty convictions on this guy. I didn't doubt that our case was strong enough. But what I really wanted is I really wanted the court to acknowledge these dogs as living beings. I wanted them to understand that at one point these dogs were vibrant living animals. So what we did, one of our strategies was to make sure that everyone in that courtroom referred to those dogs by name. So every dog had a name. You didn't call it the Black Doberman or the Black Rottweiler. You know, it was Pete and it was Sarge. You know, and for a while, one of the female dogs was a Jane Doe. And it what really did it for me on that case was when you came in, Doc, and you testified that you believe that those dogs were put into those containers and allowed to basically cook to death.
Right.
And the evidence proved that, the forensics, the necropsies, right. And your testimony is what really closed that deal, and that the courts acknowledged that. And what was really great moment in that trial was that the judge actually said it out loud, because the defense attorney tried to object to Dr. Halligan's testimony, basically saying that there's no way we could prove that those dogs were put in there alive, because he was claiming that the dogs had died of natural causes, and he puts them in the truck because then they go to rendering. And you know, we said, absolutely not. We can prove that they were put in there alive. And it was very good to see the judge not only referring to the dogs by name, but also stating, no, this court has proven that these animals were put in there alive and left to die. And it was, and Doc, your testimony is what really, I think, closed the deal on that and really satisfied the courts. And the judge agreed with that.
What happens to a person like that? I mean, is there jail time? Is there, I mean, is it, what kind of conviction, you know, when they're found guilty?
Well, technically for every felony count, he was supposed to receive 3 years in jail consecutively. But what ended up happening, he was placed on probation. He got convicted of 4 felony and 4 misdemeanor counts. And the courts agreed to give him 1 year probation. And in that 1 year, if he didn't violate probation, then the case would be reduced even more. And then that would be it. So he didn't get any jail time at all. But what he does get is probation and search conditions. And he's not allowed to own animals. I think he ended up getting 10 years. He can't own animals. Fortunately for us, a few months after that conviction, he started up his business again. So we ended up doing surveillance on him. We did extensive surveillance on him. And we went back to court and we showed the judge these videos and said, hey, look, he's doing it again. And the judge said, no way. He called him back in and he gave him a year in custody.
Wow. So he had to serve a year in jail?
Yeah. He ended up doing a year.
Oh my gosh. Thank gosh. And that was all Caesar, honestly, putting that together. I mean, my testimony, but It's very complicated to put a face together. And it and the mistakes are made in the beginning, right, Caesar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of mistakes. If you don't do it right, you know what I mean? And so...
What do you mean by that? That the mistakes are made...
Go ahead. You answer that, Caesar.
Well, and I don't know if they're mistakes in the sense that, you know, errors of judgment or anything like that. You don't realize what you should have done until you're in court at trial and you're presenting to a jury and you're like, oh man, we should have done this and we should have done that a little bit better. I think that's the type of mistakes you're referring to, right?
Let me explain another case that we lost. I mean, we won the majority of them, but we lost two. And they always stick with me because you learn the most. We had a case quickly, a dog who they were starving it. This poor Doberman, they were drug addict, husband, wife, whatever. They were, the dog was on the side of the house. And one day they decided to give it some soup. They just poured it a can of soup and its stomach blowed up and twisted and it died. Yeah, get bloated from the soup. So the officers, the first thing they do is bring you the dog because that's evidence that for me to determine how the dog died. And so I did a necropsy, which is the equivalent of an autopsy in a person. Always have a necropsy done when your animal dies, because that's how you can tell how it died. So you got to have that done. So I'm in this dark room. This is way before Caesar's time. And we had Polaroids. And I'm doing my necropsy. I mean, this stomach was blown open. I punctured the abdomen and there's just soup started spilling out. I mean, it was disgusting. Pictures of the hole in the stomach. This poor dog, can you imagine? When we went to court, I'm on the stand and I'm telling them how the dog died. And we're showing little Polaroid pictures, okay? The defense attorney gets up and he says, Dr. Halligan, isn't it possible that this dog ate a colorless, odorless substance and that's what killed the dog? That's what he said. And I looked at the judge because I'm like, no. And he goes, and he said it again. Well, guess what? They put that in the jury's mind. And because the pictures were so bad, they couldn't see the hole in the stomach, we lost the case.
Wow, shame.
So the point is, if we'd have had video and I showed the hole, like with Caesar's case, okay, we had pictures and video, and we even saved the stool. The way we won that case, the way I proved that that dog was alive, there was feces in the care in the cage. Okay. And I said, if that feces came out of that dog, that means the dog was alive because it was pushed down into the grate. So does that make sense, Joey? So there was feces through the grate. You know what I mean? And we proved with forensics that that wasn't indeed the dog's stool. So I'm like, the dog had to have been alive. Mm-hmm. So, but I guess that's what I meant, is that it's the captain, the person in charge, the cases that we lost. I know that, you know, if we'd have had like better pictures and there were other things that, you know, like he says, you know, you get in court and there's nothing you can do after the fact. And the chain of evidence is so important, and getting that necropsy done right away. And so it's really, really hard. And Caesar's very good.
I guess your team is important. Wouldn't you say that, Captain, that you want to work with a veterinarian that you're used to, so you guys, I guess, become accustomed to what's, you know, what you're looking for and all? I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's always the ideal situation, is to have a vet that, you know, once you call, you can hit the ground running, you know, because they know what they need to do. Unfortunately, that's not always the case, because sometimes in emergency situations, we have to take the animals to a local emergency hospital. So you're having to train that vet on the fly and say, okay, here's what I need. This is what I need you to examine. And like Doc said, we do HD video on everything. All our exams, everything is high definition video. So when we start the very initial exam that a veterinarian starts to do, we're video recording that, because we want to walk the jury through what we experienced. And like Doc said, if they can't see it nowadays with that CSI effect, if a jury can't see it, hear it, feel it, they're not going to believe it happened because everything is on video now. So people find it hard to believe that that you did something that didn't get recorded. So there's a little bit of doubt there. So we record everything. We record the intake exam. We record photograph, you know, necropsies as much as we can. But yeah, I mean, ideally you want to have a vet that knows all these things going into it. But unfortunately, that's not always the luxury that you have.
And what was hard for me, not hard for me, but something that I became very good at from having Don Kocek and Madeline and captains like Caesar, is that I have to explain the level of suffering that the animal is going through. And most vets don't. We're trained, like if your dog comes in and it's got a broken leg, I'm like, oh my God, your dog's in so much pain. Okay, I'm not going to say that, am I? Because you're going to freak out if I'm like, oh my God. So you kind of minimize it. That's how we're trained. But in a court, boy, I'm going to elaborate how that poor dog must have felt in that dark cage with no air and just loneliness and suffering and hungry. You see what I'm saying? And I got really good at that. And I tried to, I actually helped other vets with that because it's just not what we're trained to do. But that's what the jury needs to hear from us, is how much suffering these poor animals had to go through. And I do think that it makes a difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really, I'll tell you, it was a hard part of my life. I don't know how you do it, Caesar. I couldn't listen to music because I was just shut down emotionally. To be able to witness all that animal cruelty is very, very hard. And it's, and now that I'm away from it, it does bring back a lot of emotions for me. And I'm grateful for all the times that I was able to, you know, help put people in jail for hurting animals, because I used to go to these prosecuting attorney conferences. I was actually a member, and I remember them talking about this judge who got up there and he literally said, the case was a guy came home drunk and he was mad at his wife, and the wife had the dog on her lap, and he just shot the dog with a gun in the head and killed it. And the judge goes, I'm not going to throw someone in jail for shooting a dog. That's what he said. This was, you know, back east. But there are judges that feel that way. It's a dog. And oh, so what if it suffered, right, Caesar?
Yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, that's a mentality of a lot of people when it comes to animals. I mean, in some states, it's still legal if a dog is running at large. That's all the dog has to be doing is running at large. You can legally shoot that dog. And law enforcement can also shoot that dog. And that's the only requirement. And there were a lot of laws, obviously, when there used to be a lot of farming here, and those laws no longer exist. But yeah, if in some areas where that still exists and dogs can come in and destroy your livestock, it's legal to just shoot at a dog that comes onto your property, no questions asked, which kind of bleeds into some of the law enforcement side of officers being involved with, you know, shooting of dogs that they encounter in the field and stuff like that. Because in some areas that's still acceptable to shoot a dog that's just running at large.
And there are laws, like you said, from Food Animal, that you can do surgery on your own pet. It is legal for you. It's legal, right, Caesar?
I mean, you can perform a certain level of veterinary care on your animals. I think the way we can get around that, if we can show if an animal is suffering. So if you're cutting your dog open and you're not providing proper anesthesia, right, or pain meds or anything like that, we can try to get people that way. But yeah, we get cases all the time where people crop their dog's ears off, you know, the ears get infected or their tails, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. People do that all the time. I mean, we get cases, you know, someone's posting on Instagram a video of them sewing up their dog after they cut their ears off or something like that.
And did you know bestiality is legal in, I think, 12 states? It is still legal in several states, bestiality, which is having sex with your dog, right? Is that's the definition?
Yeah, the law in California changed recently, probably a year or two ago. It got a little bit more defined because it was very vague. It basically just said sexual assault on an animal, you know, constitutes bestiality. But now the section is a little bit more specific as to some of the acts that you can do to qualify as bestiality and to be able to get prosecuted for it. I don't recall exactly what states or how many there are that's still legal.
I think it's 12, I believe, the last time I checked. But that's just, it's never okay to be doing that to your pet. And it's sad that the United States, we still have states where that's accepted. So we do have a long way to go. And hopefully in 20 years, it won't be legal anywhere.
Well, I'm going to ask a question now because you brought that up. So, Captain, have you ever been dispatched on a bestiality case?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, I did. Wow. I did a really extensive investigation for years that ended up going nowhere. There was a woman that was having sex with dogs on video and posting them online. Mm-hmm. And she had several videos that she would post, and we had to go through and recover all the videos. So then what made it really difficult to prosecute was trying to establish jurisdiction, because we couldn't prove where these videos were made or where they occurred. This case ended up taking us into an unsolved homicide out of San Diego. That we think we know who the suspect is, and that this person may have been involved with this unsolved homicide. The FBI was involved in this case, and that there were some terrorist threats made to someone out of state because she was doing stuff online and getting money for it. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was this one case in particular that was quite extensive, that took a lot of investigation to try to figure it all out and unravel all these pieces. And we ended up not being able to get a prosecution on it, unfortunately.
Wow.
Well, I actually, towards the end, I think it was maybe my last year there, I got a call from a DA saying, I was wondering, would you be willing to testify in a bestiality case? And I'd never been involved in one. And I said, well, send me everything. So she sent me everything. Apparently there was a homeless guy living under the freeway, and he had two dogs, and he was, you know, assaulting one dog and yelling at it, and a passerby saw it. Cops came out, took the dogs to the shelter. The shelter vet didn't know how to conduct a rape kit, to, again, losing the case in the beginning. Okay. So he just did like a cursory exam, looked at the vulva, the vagina of the dog, and said everything looked fine. He didn't test for semen. You know, he didn't do any of, you know, he didn't really know what he was doing. So they had a vet record, right, that said that there was nothing physically abnormal with the dog. The dog ended up dying in the shelter. One of the two dogs died. So I said to her, well, when I started looking into it, they go into the rectum. They don't even go in the vagina. So I got into it. I had to really desensitize myself because it was really a horrible language that he was yelling at the dog and blah, blah, blah. But anyhow, so I was ready. I had an x-ray, average size of a guy's penis that could be inserted so there would be no trauma. And I was ready to testify against this guy because I educated myself on when that happens. And do you know that they backed down when they heard I was going to testify? And I didn't even have to go to court. They found out. Wow. I was going to. And so we won a conviction against that guy. And so, yeah, it's really teamwork is important. But again, like I say in the beginning, though, that poor vet didn't know what he was doing, because we aren't taught that. There's so much that we're not taught, and you do rely on people that know so much more than you. And you know, you have to put your ego aside and do what they tell you to do, you know, because this was brings back a lot of memories. Yes, it does. I mean, I think that LA now has a animal cruelty task force, right?
They actually just disbanded that unit first of the year. LAPD had detectives that were part of the animal cruelty task force, along with City of LA animal control officers. But unfortunately, they were dissolved as the first of the year.
That's bad. Yes, there's a lot.
Is that a funding issue?
Yeah, it was part of the recent budget cuts that LAPD made. There was a lot of news about that, but yeah, it was definitely came down to funding.
Well, let's end with Caesar. If someone is suspicious of animal cruelty, whether it be it's your neighbor, you're a groomer, you're a vet, you're whatever, what's the first thing they should do?
Well, if they really think that there's cruelty or neglect occurring, you contact your local animal control or SPCA, as long as the SPCA has investigation abilities like us. I mean, if you're in Los Angeles, you can go on spcala.com and report it online, or we have a call, you know, an 800 number you can call in and report that to us. But most definitely report it to your animal control or your SPCA in your community. If it's something that's egregious, that's happening now, you know, a crime in progress, you can call 911. I mean, I know a lot of times with dogs and hot cars and stuff like that, I mean, there's no time to waste on those. You can call 911 for something that's occurring now that's definitely going to cause harm to that animal.
And there is a study, or there are studies that show that there's links. People that hurt animals will go on to hurt people, right, Caesar?
Absolutely. It's just they're practicing to become more horrible human beings later.
Yes. Yes. So please, please report animal cruelty if you see it. And Caesar, thank you for taking the time to come on.
Great.
And if people want to get a hold of you, do you feel comfortable giving out any type of contact information or an 800 number or?
Yeah, I mean, you can like I said, go to spcala.com and you can report animal cruelty there.
Okay.
I have a social media presence where I have some of my media and stuff that I do. I can be reached there. And it's caesarperea.com. So it's caesarperea.com. And you can reach me there also.
Great. That's wonderful. Great. Yes. Thank you so much for coming on, and continue to do the fight, because you're good and the animals are happy to have you advocating for them.
Great. Thank you for having me. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more free vet advice. And, you know, we're pretty entertaining, aren't we, Joey?
I think so. I definitely think so. And make sure that you like and share. That's really important. And give us questions. We want questions. We want to know what you want us to talk about. So you can email your questions to docandjoeyunleashed@gmail.com.